Okay, shall we begin? I screwed up last time and was a little late in finishing the lecture, so we did not have Twitter cards. But we will have Twitter cards pretty much every time subsequently. So can I move this? Yeah, there it is. So I want to remind you also that we have no class a week from today. A week from today, we will not meet here for class. And as a replacement for that class, we will have class at my house. There's the address, 800 West 5th Street, apartment 1102. And that will be at times according to your discussion section. Now, if you have some reason why that time doesn't work for you, then you can go to any of the other times and just make sure your TA knows that you're going to a different section. So easily accessible, shouldn't be any transportation problems. So that's next Saturday, February 2nd, at those various times. So today, we are extending this discussion on the sort of first series here that I told you about. We did the 10 terms. We did last time the historical perspective. And this time, we're focusing on what is a creative age like. Now, you know, there are different ways you can understand this class in that talk on historical perspective last time. And actually, Philip, are you back in the back? Could you turn the lights up for a little bit here? Because we're not going to have, we're going to talk for a bit before we go beyond this. So in that historical perspective, we were talking about the fact that, you know, we move from an agricultural age to a mercantile age, to an industrial age, to an organizational age. Philip, you might also see if you can crank it. It looks like it's sort of halfway between two slides instead of locked into a slide. So we talked about the difference in all those and the economic difference, certainly in the agricultural age, completely different economic situation in the mercantile and the industrial and the organizational and now the creative age. And we also talked about the fact that that implied certain differences in the political context in those periods, who had power and how you could exert power. And we talked about how it also had social and cultural differences, that people related to each other different ways, and there were different cultural expressions in one era than in another era. Now, today and on Saturday, we're going to expand that a little bit. So I would say that there are transitions in economic characteristics of a society. There are transitions in social and cultural. But maybe even more interesting and fundamental is transitions in actual lifestyle. And maybe even what human beings are in these different eras. And so in a kind of macro sense, imagine that you're in the agricultural age and that your life, day to day to day, is getting up really early in the morning, going out and tending your stock and starting to work in your field, and you work probably 12 hours, hard labor. I mean, hard labor, back-breaking work all day long. You probably eat twice as many or three times as many calories as we would eat today because you have to have that. You're doing hard physical labor all the time. And you're doing that day in, day out, 7 days a week. That cow has to be milked on Saturday and Sunday just exactly like she's milked the other 5 days of the week. And that, you know something? There's not any transition. You're not going to get promoted. And your job's going to be different in 5 years. You're going to do the same damn thing all your life. And it's not like you had any choice about what you're doing. You are doing what you're doing because that's what your father did or your mother did. And there's not any movement. It's just, this is the way it is and this is the way it's going to be. And tradition rules everything. In the agricultural age, things didn't change for millennia. Now imagine you as a human being living a life like that. Absolutely routine. It's going to be that way all your life. Very, very hard physical labor. We are simply not equipped as human beings to do that. Your body couldn't stand the difficult labor that would be involved in that. Your mind would be so bored, you would just go nuts. So as there is a transition from the agricultural age, the mercantile age, and so on, there is a change in us as human beings. How we think, how we operate, even physically, even, everything pretty much changes. So let's just take a little difference, say, between the organizational age and the creative age. So think of your grandparents when they went to school. So probably in kindergarten, first grade, when they're going to school, number one, they're all sitting in desks really early. You learn to sit in your desk and behave yourself. And you get in rows, and your posture is really important. You're supposed to sit up straight in your seat, and you're supposed to be disciplined and learn to, be a good boy or girl in class. Now, I can remember when I was a little kid, they had in our report card, on the left-hand side was all your grades and all your subjects. On the right-hand side was about your behavior. Were you behaving properly? We don't have that on report cards anymore. But the very top line of that behavioral thing was disciplines himself or herself. And I always got crap in disciplines himself. I was the kid who couldn't sit still, who wasn't following all the rules, wasn't sitting straight in my chair, in my row, being a good boy. I did fine on the left-hand side, drove me nuts. But in the organizational age, you were meant to be a disciplined, orderly human being. You weren't meant to fit into the mold. You were meant to become a part of the workforce, the crowd. And even physiologically, even just in terms of the way your body works, you were meant to control yourself and be a little more orderly. Now, in kindergarten or first grade, you've got the freaking kids down there, they got a rug on the floor, and they're all, in their little work area or play area, there are lots of Montessori, and they're, and kids are, whatever body motion they want, and they're constantly moving back and forth, and they're going inside, and they're going outside. We just, in my office, did this fantastic Montessori school for a disadvantaged neighborhood here in Austin. Love that place. These kids have a completely different lifestyle or experience of school than what was dominant in the organizational age. So I'm saying this is, it's pervasive. It actually is just, we just behave differently and we think differently in a creative age. So today and on Saturday, we're going to be thinking about how this affects lifestyle, behavior, human development, who you are. And I think you can see from the larger historical development, oh my God, please do not put me back in the agricultural age. But even from maybe more recent, from your grandparents to you, what has changed in terms of the way we work, the way we think, the way we operate, the way we behave, as a result of the kind of thing we're expected to do, to be more creative, and how is that linked? So I was I think there's several different ways you can take this class. So I'm perfectly happy if you say, I'm going to take this class as information. And I think it's good information for you to think about, like, the economic changes and what's different in the 21st century. I think it's very good to think about what social and cultural changes. I think it's just, this is good information for you to know. So if you just take the class as just information, I'm good with that. And I think it could be very beneficial to you. And then there's some of you that'll say, okay, I'm going to go one step further than that. I really do want to get some of these skills. I'm going to use this class to increase my confidence or to increase my comfort with indeterminacy or to increase my independent thinking. I want these tools. I want to be better at this. And I'm going to use this class as a device for doing that. And I'm so good with that. That's great. That's a second way you can use this class. Or a third way you can use this class, and this is maybe the more extreme case, is to say, you know something? This is more pervasive than just learning skills. This is about how I operate, how I think, the kind of lifestyle I live. I can either make myself a more creative person by the lifestyle I lead, or I can make myself a less creative person. And I really do believe it gets, if we're going to be a really creative person, it has something to do with more than just skills. It has to do with a way of thinking, a way of living, a way of moving, a way. It's pervasive. It kind of dominates how you develop yourself. So there'll be some of you, I think, who say, yeah, I want to go that far. And these next two lectures today and on Saturday are, you know, introducing that notion of what would that mean? What is a creative age like? What is a person who optimizes their performance in the context of a creative culture? So I was having this conversation with a guy who took this class a year ago. His name is Dijon Green, and he had taken Architecture and Society in the fall of 2017, and then he took Creative Problem Solving in the spring of 2018. There are many of you who did that same sequence a year later. But Dijon is now a year away from taking the class, and he had some interesting perspective on, you know, how it worked, how it didn't work for him. And from that conversation, I said, yeah, Dijon, would you come and tell my class what you just told me? So, yeah, it took a little arm twisting, but I asked Dijon to come this morning. And he's just going to say a little bit about his experience with the class, now a year away from it, and what the possibilities might be. So the floor is yours.
Yes, sir. Hello, everyone. My name is Dijon Green. I'm a second-year student, architecture major now. So, but as he just pointed out, Architecture and Society was first for me. I took that class and blew me away. Completely enjoyed that class. Like, I had such a good time in that class. So I, moving into my next semester, and I was looking on a computer because we all go through the whole class search, you know. We all do that. So I saw creative problem solving, and I saw Professor Speck, and I'm like, that's the one I'm going to take, because I had such a great time in Architecture and Society, right? So I come here, and obviously this whole space is not exactly like Architecture and Society. It took me about 2 weeks to figure out that this class is not exactly like Architecture and Society. So after I realized that, then I'm like, oh man, I don't quite know how I'm going to go about it, but I tried my best to kind of apply myself based on what was being taught. So I was kind of coasting a little bit. I mean, I was interested. I was still interested, but I was still coasting a little bit. And then he began to present this, the previous projects of other students and how they were taking real-life problems and they were using what was taught in this class to creatively solve those problems. And that is what kind of grabbed my attention. So then I asked myself, like, okay, am I brave enough then to take like a real life problem? Because people are going to see what it is when I do the final project, you know, it's on the slides, right? And I just had to kind of deal with that for a little while. And I kind of came to the conclusion, like, what do I have to lose? I mean, what's the worst they can do? They can laugh at me. They can make fun of me, right? People did that when I was in middle school, so I'm kind of used to it anyway. So it's like, I'll go for it. So I let my TA know what it was, and I threw in some other topics because they're going to make you choose. They're going to make you choose, like, three topics. So I was like, what do you think about this one? And he's like, I think that's it. And I was like, well, I had some other ones. Look at these. And he's like, no. I think that's the one. And my particular personal real-life problem was dealing with anger, aggression, and rage. I know I'm a small guy. Probably doesn't look like I do a lot of damage. But that's not the case. So that's what it was. And so I set out to do this. It's much different than having a problem and saying, oh, I'm just going to stop doing that. Yeah, I tried that. I tried that a million times. So some of the lectures, Albert Einstein, introvert, extrovert, which you guys are probably not there yet, but you'll see. You'll see what I mean. Some of those same lectures and what we learned in those lectures helped me to apply this same knowledge to real-life problems. Also, journaling. Not the biggest fan of journaling. In fact, I don't know anything about journaling, but they forced me to journal. As it turns out, that's what helped me the most, because it was tracking my behavior. It was tracking my thoughts. And so I developed a better way of looking at myself by writing it down. And so now, like, I'm looking at every entry, and I'm beginning to see like a thread, like a pattern. I'm like, okay, so that's what the issue is. So then it actually helped me. Never thought that was possible. Especially, like, I don't even like this room. I feel like it's like a movie theater / class. It's just awkward, you know? But I know he was doing his absolute best. So in retrospect, I approached this class, wasn't quite exactly what I expected, because architecture and society blew me away. But it turns out that this class blew me away as well, because I decided to, like, instead of finding some little small problem, like solving how people walk through the gym, maybe they should put a list on the side here if they're going to use the weights. Instead of coming up with something simple like that, I actually chose something that was like real life. It's a real life issue. And that's what forced me to get involved and read the documents and like check out the videos and do everything that was necessary, the research, the effort, putting in the time. That is what helped change how I feel about creative problem solving, for sure, but definitely how I felt about this class. So I'm living proof that if you're brave enough, if you're up for it, to take up a real-life problem and use what you learn, because you will learn some very interesting things. I mean, what I learned about Albert Einstein was very interesting to me. But this class definitely helped me, and it can help you as well.
So I really appreciate it, Dijon. That was that took a little confidence to do that. So you know that in your project you have three options. You can choose a societal problem, and we talked about with our guests last time. You know, there are helps you can do campus wide, and if you want to take a social problem, that is fantastic. And try to see how do I solve that problem. You can take a community problem, one maybe more local, maybe with the people you interact with day to day, and you can try to solve a problem there. Or you can do as Dijon did and choose a problem that is a personal problem, that it's something that you deal with. And you can say, kind of find a creative solution to that. As he said, you know, his initial dealing with his rage and his anger was just to say, I need to stop doing that. I need to stop getting mad. But that never worked. He still kept getting really angry and losing it sometimes. So he had to really go back and think, what is a creative solution to this problem? And how can I reframe how I'm thinking about my behavior? And how can I alter that? So I think he's trying to make himself a better
equipped human being to be successful in a creative age and be able to be collaborative and be able to interact with other people in a very positive kind of way. So, you know, that's out there if it's something you want to do. So I just want to check in again today on your reading. So I did a little poll last time on the Rise of the Creative class and asked you how your reading was going on that. I want to do the same thing with the reading that was due to be finished today. And the same three options. Did you read the whole damn thing? Did you read part of it? Did you not yet crack it? So, again, total honesty, no repercussions. How many people have read all of the reading in Dan Pink? Okay, cool. How many people have read part of the reading? Okay, and how many people have not started that reading? Okay, that's good. I want to talk a little about that reading. It really builds on this notion of historical perspective. He's also talking about a change that has happened in culture and how it affects motivation. So he talks about motivation 1.0, which was the agricultural age, a significant portion of the mercantile age, where it was about survival. So that people were motivated to work and to do things because they had to freaking survive. They had to eat. And if they didn't do those things, they wouldn't eat. They wouldn't have shelter. It was just all about survival. And then he talks about motivation 2.0, a second kind of operating system for human beings, where it's more about carrot and stick. So it's transactional. This is where the mercantile age began, this notion of transaction, but you not only sell me your beans and I give you my meat, that kind of transaction, but there also began to be transactions about time and about work. So that you're motivated to work by the fact that I give you money in exchange for that. It's carrot and stick motivation. Either I give you money to do it or I beat you on the head if you don't do it. But either way, you're motivated by this external motivation of something transactional with someone else. That's motivation 2.0, and that would have been dominant in industrial age, organizational age, absolutely name of the game in industrial age. I mean, in the organizational age, it really was what created hierarchies. You've got a boss, you've got work, you've got remuneration, you've got raises, you've got, you know, there's all kinds of transactional things that motivate you, or there are all kinds of you're going to lose your job or you're going to, be demoted or, you know, these transactional things that are sticks as well as carrots. So the organization is very much about carrot and stick motivation. Now, Dan Pink is talking about this third operating system, that is motivation 3.0, and that is intrinsic motivation. I do this because I get satisfaction from it. I want to do it. I am intrinsically motivated to do this. And he's saying, in the creative age, this is very, very, very important that you will be better at doing creative work if you have intrinsic motivation, motivation 3.0. So this book, Drive, is fantastic. I highly recommend the whole book. You're just reading one chapter, but in other parts of that book, he discusses this at great length. And he talks a lot about this researcher at Harvard Business School named Teresa Amabile. And he quotes from her where she says, "Intrinsic motivation is conducive to creativity. Controlling extrinsic motivation is detrimental to creativity." That's a pretty powerful statement. So she says that if you're doing creative work, you need to have intrinsic motivation. If you're doing not creative work, maybe carrot and stick works great. But for creative work, you need intrinsic motivation. She talks about it as two different kinds of work. She calls it heuristic work, which is more creative work, or algorithmic work, which is more routine, more monkey see,
do more linear kind of work. So she says if you're doing algorithmic work, then one kind of motivation works well. If you're doing heuristic work, creative work, it takes another kind of motivation. And she talks about two studies. These blow me away. These studies totally blow me away. So in one of the studies, they take little kids in preschool. We've got three groups of little kids. First, they look at all the little kids in preschool, and they observe the ones that like to draw. And they pull out the kids who like to draw. And then they divide them into three groups. All of them like to draw. And so they take one of the groups, and they put them in one room. And they say, just, you know, play with whatever you want to play with, toys, the games, the books, you know. Or you can draw if you want to draw. Do it, do whatever you want to do and do as much of it as you want to. And these kids, they love to draw, so they just draw and draw and draw and draw and draw in that room. They take the other one-third of the kids, and they put them in a room, and they say, you know, you can do anything you want, play with any of these games exactly the same way. But at the end of the day, if they draw a lot, they give them a reward. They give them a prize. And then the third group, they put them in another room, and they tell them at the beginning, you can do any of these things. You can play, you can, you know, watch TV, you can do these video exercises, or you can draw. But if you draw, we're going to give you a prize. So carrot and stick motivation. We're going to give you a bonus if you draw more. And then they leave these kids in these three rooms and let them operate for 3 weeks. And then at the end of the 3 weeks, they take them back and put them in the larger room with everybody else, and they observe their behavior. So the kids who were in the room where they just let them draw and they didn't give them any bonuses, didn't do anything, they continued to just draw like crazy when they went back in the big room. They love to draw, and so they're motivated, and they do it, and they're just producing like crazy. The second group that, after the fact, did get a prize, not if you do this, then you get that, but they gave them a prize. They also did great. When they went back in the classroom, they continued to draw a lot. But the third group, when they gave them a carrot and stick motivation, when they said, if you do this, then we'll give you that, they stopped drawing. When they went back in the big room, if you're not giving me a prize, I'm not drawing. And it actually deterred their creative activity. Carrot and stick motivation moved the activity of drawing to a different part of their brain, a part of their brain that was transactional and that made them think, I have to have a prize in order to do this, and took it out of that part of their brain where it was intrinsic, where they did it because they wanted to do it. And when they moved that activity to that part of the brain that was more algorithmic, then when they didn't have the motivation, they didn't have the carrot or the stick, they stopped doing it. Her conclusion from that is that if we take creative activities and we put them in a carrot-stick context, we may actually deter motivation. We need to have that motivation that is intrinsic. Okay, another little social science study that she talks about. So this is with college students. And they took a whole bunch of college students, and they divided them into two groups. And they gave them all the same challenge. And the challenge was to take a candle and some matches and a box of tacks. And you're sitting there where there's a table and a wood wall, and your challenge is to light the candle and let it burn without dripping on the table. So you have a candle, you have some matches, you have a box of tacks, and you have to figure out how to deal with this. And so one group was just asked to solve the problem, and the other group, they said, for those of you who solve it the fastest, you get $5. For the
five of you that solve it the fastest, we're going to give you $5. So the idea was to do it efficiently, do it quickly, and be successful. It turns out that the group that was given the motivation of the $5, the average time it took them to solve that problem was 3.5 minutes longer than the group that had no $5 motivation. Because again, if you put it in a transactional way, it moves to a part of your brain that thinks algorithmically, if then, thinks transactionally, and takes it away from the part of your brain that is more accustomed to, this is fun, let me figure this out, I'm curious, and it takes them longer. They eventually got the solution, but it took them longer. So this is a very interesting idea, that actually the context that you put yourself in when you're given a problem that needs a creative solution can either motivate you to do it and do it fast and do it with intrinsic motivation, or it can maybe deter your actual performance because you're thinking of it in a more transactional way. Now, I think that's really fascinating. I'm not necessarily saying you need to believe that, but I think that's a kind of, if in fact that's true, then you have to think of, if I want to do creative work, I need to put myself in a context where I can use my intrinsic motivation. Okay, now I want a little reaction from you. Do you think that's bullshit? Do you think there's something to that? What do you think?
So if there is kind of something to it, something that was just kind of going through my head was, like, if it's supposed to be like, you know, this class is, you know, of course, supposed to be like fun and stuff like that. Like, we're supposed to learn about like how to creative problem solve. Isn't it like being graded, like kind of getting the same kind of reward thing, like if you're given $5 versus, you know, if you're given 100, like that was just something that was kind of going through my head.
That is a really good point. And I have faced this before. Because this is a class and because you get a grade, does that already move it into motivation 2.0 instead of motivation 3.0? Now, this is my perspective on this, is that in any creative problem, there are some aspects of it that are algorithmic. And there's some aspects of it that are heuristic. So I would say in this class, there are some algorithmic things that if you do them and you'll be successful and you'll get that grade. The other half of it is, are you motivated to do the rest? And that's on you. So I'm given a framework that I work within, and there is going to be an algorithmic aspect to this class. And any creative problem solving requires some algorithmic kind of work, fact finding, you know, information, that sort of thing. But how far you go beyond that? So like, do you do the DJ thing or do you not do the DJ thing? Are you intrinsically motivated to go beyond that and really espouse it or not? And you know, you're not going to get graded on that. Your grade will have nothing to do with that. And I told you just a minute ago, I don't have a stock in how you decide to deal with this class. I'm taking it out of that grading system. And you know, but I would love it if you had the intrinsic motivation to take it further. Does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Yeah. So what do you think?
This reminded me of two things from my life, and I think it probably is applicable to most people in our generation that are forced to read, because I didn't grow up reading, like, before school. I didn't really read that much. Mostly my parents read me picture books, and then all of a sudden I'm started to be forced to read, and I was never really like, ooh, this is a fun activity that I enjoy doing, but it was always just like, this is something that's you have to do or you're going to get in trouble. So I always hated reading. And now I'm only starting to like kind of see like why it might be intrinsically fun and like enjoyable.
That is a really good point, and that's a really good example. And I think if when you're a little kid, it's like, okay, here's a treat, let's read a book. It's a totally different thing. And then, do you want to read a book? If you don't want to read a book, fine, we're not reading books, you know? And then it puts it in the realm of intrinsic motivation. Big difference. So somebody had a hand up back here. Did someone have a? Yeah, okay. So what do you think?
I was actually going to say the exact same type of grading thing as the previous guy, the guy who first spoke, but also like how our society in general, like everything, it kind of has like a characteristic motivation. Mm-hmm. You do a job, you get $12.50 an hour. Mm-hmm. You study hard, you do good on a test, you get 90, 100 A in a class. So it's kind of like interesting how like our society as a whole has grown towards that. Like you do this and you get a reward at the end, or you work towards that reward. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know, maybe you know people like this. I definitely know people like this. So in my office, I'm a senior principal. A firm has 500 people. I have lots of employees. I would say that probably 60% of the people who work from intrinsic motivation. They are working because they freaking love what they do. And they also get great satisfaction from it. And if they realize this is not working well, it bugs the hell out of them. They just can't stand it, and they have to keep working until it works really well. There is an enormous amount of intrinsic motivation in that workplace. Now, we do pay salaries, okay? So there is some carrot and stick motivation as well. But I would say a huge, and I can definitely say personally, I work my ass off. I really work really hard. I'm working hard in this class. And it's not because they're going to pay me more money if I work harder in this class. If I've got my psychic energy invested in this class, UT will not pay me one penny more. They don't freaking care. They just want to make me generate my semester credit hours, okay? But I'm motivated to teach this class because I believe in what this is about. And I want you to have a more successful career and life. And I believe this is a ticket to help you do that. And it's intrinsic motivation. So it's not that you can't let carrot and stick motivation and intrinsic motivation coexist. It's not that you can't have a job where, yes, there is some carrot and stick motivation, but there also is intrinsic motivation. And what's really driving me is that. And I'll guarantee you, I mean, I have two sons who I know their psyche extremely well. And they have fought and fought and fought to get a job where they can exercise their intrinsic motivation. Because that's just like so much cooler and more fun. Both of them get paid well, and they're doing fine on the carrot stick thing. But what was really important is I want a job where I'm motivated. I go to work in the morning, I'm excited about what I'm doing. I feel a sense of accomplishment. I'm making the world better. And I think actually your generation, and I think a creative age, is characterized by a lot more people who have that intrinsic motivation. Now, is that right for everybody? Absolutely not. Richard Florida says that 30% of the current American economy is the creative class. 30%. I'm just saying, maybe you want to be part of that 30%, maybe you don't want to be part of that 30%. There's 70% out there that you can just, do fine with carrot and stick motivation. It's cool. And then maybe on the weekends you go rock climbing because you love doing that, and that's great. And that's maybe a different kind of creative outlet for you. What do you think?
I just had a question. So you said that people who work in like the creative careers, like they're motivated by intrinsic motivation, but like at what point do you like revert back to like motivation 2.0 because like you're not making enough money from doing your nonprofit and you have to pay your rent and buy food? So like at what point do you just go back to like survival skills?
Mm-hmm. So I think that's a very realistic thing. So my younger son, I mentioned earlier, he's a do-gooder, and he really wants to help disadvantaged people. And, working for nonprofits, he makes, like, sucky salary. He's got a baby. He's got, he wants to be able to give that kid good things and education and all that. It's not like he was starving with the nonprofit, but, it wasn't making what he wanted to. Now he works for a B Corp that actually makes money and also does good for disadvantaged people. So it's possible to find it where you can do both. But it's, it's what you work at it. And I don't think it's a black-white thing. And part of your job may well be algorithmic, and part of your job may well be heuristic, and part of your motivation may be carrot and stick, and part of your motivation may be intrinsic motivation. Yeah.
How I kind of see it is, like, people like to have choices, and when you're, like, limited, then kind of you want to go against the grain and rebel, and so that in the case of, like, the elementary students, mm-hmm. they were kind of, like, acting rebellious towards, like, not having the decision whether they can have a prize or not, so, mm-hmm. yeah.
So it's a little bit about control and feeling like you're in the driver's seat. And I think that's the notion of intrinsic motivation is, I'm doing this because I'm in control and I'm making these decisions and I want to do it. And I think that is motivational, and I think particularly motivational when you're trying to do creative work. Yeah, we're going to have to shut down on this, but what do you think?
So I think that a lot of the intrinsic motivation comes from a few different aspects and when you're like looking for different types of work. So I did a lot of reading over the summer, and a large part of it was just finding meaning in your work. And when you have an external meaning or something to strive for, that's where the intrinsic motivation sort of comes from. And being able to have the autonomy within your work is what allows you to strive and to be able to make your own choices and understand that you have the responsibility to sort of obtain these different goals that you set for yourself.
That is exactly what we're talking about today and at my house on Saturday. Things like autonomy. How much autonomy do you have in your work? And that's a huge thing of whether you have intrinsic motivation or not. Okay, let's proceed a bit here. So we've been talking about Richard Florida. We're going to retire him before too long. But this notion that this is a key factor in our economy and in society, and that both in work, and we're talking about work to some extent here, but also other spheres of your life. Family life, relationships with other people. We value creativity more highly than ever, and we cultivate it more intensely. And Florida says that the creative impulse, that attribute that distinguishes us as humans from other species, is now being let loose at an unprecedented scale. So if we want to be a part of that, what does that really mean? And one huge takeaway today is these 8 characteristics of creative people. And these are ones that Richard Florida outlines in the book, 8 characteristics of creative people. So if I want to be in that 30% that are the creative class, what are the characteristics of those people? Number one, it's more than intelligence. Although intelligence is helpful in creativity, being smart is a great thing. Being smart is the ability to use data, understand data, analyze data, and process large amounts of it. And that favors a creative potential, but that's not it alone. It's not synonymous with creativity. So number one, it's more than intelligence. The second way we understand creative people is they have the ability to synthesize. And we're going to talk about this over and over. We're going to look at Einstein. Dijon was talking about that because he's a very interesting case in point of synthesis. He said that what he did, his work, was combinatory play. That you take things that don't normally go together and you smash them together and they create something new. We'll talk about him, but he had a huge love of music. He was a great violinist. He was a huge lover of philosophy, read philosophy, had a little, you know, book club that they read philosophy together for decades. And yet he was a scientist. He was a physicist. So how do physics and music and philosophy merge together? And he said it was that combinatory play, that synthesis of different things. That's how he made real creative leaps in physics. So it's a matter of sifting through data, perceptions, and materials to come up with combinations that are new and useful. So do you have the ability to synthesize, to take disparate pieces and put them together in a different way? That's a second characteristic of creative people. The third is that creative people have self-assurance and the ability to take risks. We've talked about this to some extent before, but Richard Florida says a person needs a healthy self-respect to pursue novel ideas and to be able to make mistakes despite criticism from others, because almost always there's going to be some disagreement to a new idea. Self-doubt there may be, that's not a problem, but it cannot always win the day. And it also needs to be just a building of confidence, a sense of self-assurance, the ability to, even when people disagree with you, you still kind of stick with your guns. So that third thing is self-assurance. The fourth characteristic of creative people is that they have subversion. They are given to rebellion. Richard Florida says creative work is downright subversive. All creativity is an act of rebellion. And I don't mean rebellion in a mean or ugly way. It's just that you don't accept the status quo. You just can't say, everything's cool. I like the way things are just like they are. If you feel that way, why would you do anything different or anything new or anything innovative? You have to have some little itch inside you that says something's wrong here. This is not right. This could be better. There needs to be a little bit of rebellion there. A fifth characteristic of creative people is that creative people have great ordinary abilities. And by ordinary abilities, it's things like noticing, remembering, seeing, speaking, hearing, understanding language, and recognizing analogies. All of these very common talents are really, really important in creative problem solving. And these are things you can work on. How do I notice things better? How do I see things more thoroughly? How do I understand someone's point of view? How do I listen more carefully? How do I understand deeply what someone is feeling or thinking? How do I recognize points and analogies that might be made? Those ordinary abilities are super important to being a creative person. The sixth item is creative people use the four-step process. Sometimes they use it explicitly, and sometimes they use it implicitly. But almost every creative act involves this four-step process. And I'm going to harp on this all through the semester. So get this one down in your notes, because you're going to be asked to use the four-step process. In your project, you're going to need to use the four-step process. The first step is preparation. And that's really the research phase of what you're doing. You need to find out information. You can't just be creative on the fly. Really deep, profound, meaningful creativity comes because somebody has prepared themselves to approach that problem and to solve it, and they know what they're doing. And in your project, there's going to be a period of really researching and preparing yourself. That's, by the way, pretty algorithmic work. That part of it is very algorithmic work. Then the second stage is incubation. So it's mulling it over, thinking it through, rolling it around in your brain, maybe brainstorming it with other people. You're not directly trying to find a solution. You're just sort of imagining and thinking and dreaming and letting it roll around in your brain. Incubation. The third phase is illumination. In that moment of trying to pull it together and say, what have I got here? What's happening here? Some people refer to this as the aha moment, where you start to see insight or a glimmer of a direction that's there. And then the fourth step is verification or revision. You either say, yes, this is working, it's doing what it needs to, or that didn't really work. Now I've got to go back through the four steps again. I need to go back and do more research, try some more incubation, try another kind of illumination, and then test it once again. And that's just the creative process. One example I love to use of this is, because it's in my field, But Frank Lloyd Wright, the most famous architect ever in the world, probably, and his most famous work is a house called Falling Water outside of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. And they're fantastic accounts of how he did that house. He was not a kid. He was in his 60s when he did that house. He was a mature designer. So at this point, that process was not explicit. It was totally built into the way he thought and the way he worked. He didn't have to think about it. That's just the way his mind approached any problem, by the four-step process. So the first step, he goes to visit Edgar Kaufman in Pittsburgh, and they go out to the site for Falling Water. There's a beautiful drawing that he did of the topography and of the rocks and the little stream that was going through there. And, you know, he did very, very thorough documentation and research. And we have all the notes from that. We know what his preparation stage was like. And then he left Pittsburgh, went back to his office in Spring Green, Wisconsin, and apparently didn't do jack shit for about 4 or 5 months. Nothing. It just didn't appear that Frank Lloyd Wright was working on this project at all. But in fact, what he was doing was incubation. He was mulling it over in his head. He was thinking of it. He was imagining it. He was picturing himself in spaces located on that site, how they would work, what they would be made of. He's solving the problem in his head in a million different ideas and imaginations. It's a period of incubation. Then after about 4 or 5 months, Edgar Kaufman's getting a little worried. He's heard nothing from his architect. You know, I'm expecting to build a house here. I want to see what's going. So he doesn't want to be too insistent. Frank Lloyd Wright's a very famous architect. He didn't want to piss him off. But he calls him up and he says, Frank, I'm going to be in Chicago on business the end of this week. And that's not far from your place in Wisconsin. I thought I'd just take the train up and see what kind of progress you're making on my house. So I'll be there on Thursday. Is that okay? And Frank says, sure, absolutely, Edgar. You know, come on, that'll be great. So it's like Tuesday, and the client's coming on Thursday, and the people in the office are like, we haven't done anything on that project. This is going to be super embarrassing. We're screwed. You know, how could you tell him to come out here? So Frank Lloyd Wright sits down, and in a day, he sketches out the design for Falling Water. Plans and sections and little drawings of what it would be like. Just draws it. And then he gives it to his staff, and they kind of shape up the drawings a little bit. Edgar Kaufman takes the train up. Frank meets him at the station. They come in, have lunch. The staff bring in these drawings, and the thing is absolutely magnificent. And honestly, it is exactly the house that's there now. It just came out full-blown out of his head in a very short period of time. Now, there would be some people who would say, what a genius. You know, he could just make a napkin sketch and just solve problems just like that. Bullshit. He did preparation. He did documentation. He did research. He understood everything about the problem. And then he had a period of incubation where that was rolling over in his head. And then he was prepared for the moment of illumination where he could put it all out on paper. And then there was the verification of everybody saying, oh, man, this is going to be amazing. And they built the house. That's how the creative process works. Preparation, incubation, illumination, and verification or revision. So almost in any field, you look at creative people, they follow the four-step process. The seventh characteristic is creativity is favored by an intellect that has been enriched with diverse experiences and perspectives. You have to have what we'll talk about in this class as an experiential life. It's associated with a mind that exhibits a variety of interests and knowledge, that you're actually curious about a lot of things, and you explore diverse things, and you have diverse experiences. This helps make you a more creative person. And this is where I'm talking about lifestyle. I mean, if you just hold yourself up in a cubicle over at Dell in Round Rock, and you have your entire 50-year career sitting in your cubicle and working your 40-hour week every week and taking your two-week vacation and sitting on your ass in front of the TV back in your house at Round Rock, and you lead a very boring, uniform life with no diverse experiences, you will not be doing creative software engineering for Dell. You have to have more diverse experiences. You have to have some input, some stimulation, and that's a characteristic of creative people, that they orchestrate their life so they have diverse experiences and stimulation. And the seventh characteristic of creative people is hard work. Creativity is 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. And for those people who think, oh yeah, the cool thing about creativity is you can just kind of coast. You know, you get a really good idea and then, damn, you know, it wins the day and you're famous and you're remunerated and everything's cool. Creativity is very hard work. I think we'll look at lots and lots of case studies, but it often is hard work that is motivated by intrinsic motivation. It's not like somebody's beating somebody over the head with a stick to get them to work, but it is hard work. And often hard work that people are doing because they love to do it. Okay, so that's eight characteristics of creative people. A big question here is, can we all be more creative? Can we imagine a culture where there is a lot more of the population that is creative? And one of the just fantastic examples of this that I have observed is Southwest Airlines. I am very, very top of A-list with Southwest Airlines. I think I flew 137 flights last year. I mean, I fly a lot. I flew to Dallas yesterday, then flew from Dallas to San Antonio, had a meeting in San Antonio and drove back last night. So, and next Wednesday I'll do the same thing. So I'm on Southwest Airlines a ton. I love this company. Sometimes I get pissed off at this company, but, you know, because what they do is hard, transporting millions of people all over the world all the time. This is hard work. But they are a creative company, and they do creative problem solving extremely well. And the beginning of that was Herb Kelleher. Herb Kelleher died about a month ago, and there was the biggest ass funeral you have ever seen in your life in San Antonio a week ago. There were thousands of people at that funeral for Herb Kelleher, and most of them were Southwest Airlines employees. They love Herb Kelleher. He was a god in that company because he started that company based on creativity. Number one, they broke all the rules right at the beginning. You know, every airline, you got assigned a seat, and you went and sat on 14B. That's how all airlines operated. He didn't operate that way. It's kind of, at the beginning, it was just first come, first serve. You show up early, you get the best seat. You show up late, you get the worst seat. Later on, it got to be more like, okay, you know, you go online at the right time, you get the better seat. You don't, you get the worst seat. But anyways, and also, it's not like, okay, I got 14B, and right next to me in 14C is this enormous fat guy that's hanging over my seat. Nope, you can walk on that airplane, and if you see that enormous fat guy, you don't have to sit by him. You can sit by whoever you want to sit by. And it gives you a lot more choice. So he broke all the rules that way. He did not have cooperation with other airlines. If you get bumped off a Southwest Airlines flight, you're not going to be moved over to United. Won't happen. He never, ever believed in that. Our company is our company. Everybody else is everybody else. To this day, I mean, everybody else is charging you for an extra bag or, you know, everything they can possibly charge you for. Southwest Airlines is like, you know, you pay what you pay and then do whatever you want. Bring your bags on. Yeah, we don't care. They feed you peanuts. Then when people objected to the allergies, Now they feed you pretzels. Nobody feeds you on it. They charge you for something they're going to give you. He broke all the rules. And then he encouraged his employees to break all the rules and to be creative and be inventive. I can't tell you how many amazing Southwest Airlines flight attendant shows I've seen. People who sing the FAA required little ditty that they have to tell you at the beginning of the flight, or they make a poem out of it. They exert their own personality. Southwest Airlines has about 14 different options for their flight attendants' clothes. You can wear shorts, you can wear sweaters, jackets, you can get all dressed up to be a flight attendant. You can be super casual and be a flight attendant. It's up to you. You know, they have to wear the colors so you know which ones are the flight attendants, but they allow you a lot of personal expression in that. They also give you responsibility and let you do your job the way you think it should be done best. So I was on a flight in Denver. I was booked on American to go from Denver back to Austin. And the flight got canceled. I had to get back to Austin. And the flight got canceled. And their explanation was, yeah, we'll put you on one tomorrow. I need to get back to Austin. I realized there was a Southwest flight that was leaving in about 30 minutes. And I ran over to the Southwest counter. And I told the lady at the counter, I got to be on that flight in 30 minutes. And she said, dude, we're getting you on that flight. And, she showed me a back way. I didn't know there was a back way in the Denver airport where you don't go on the damn train, but you got there faster. And she said, give me your credit card. She swiped the credit card. I'll do all the paperwork. You just run. And she called the gate out there and said, hold up, Mr. Speck's coming. And she got me on that airplane. She just made it happen. That's creative problem solving. I had a problem, instead of saying, oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Speck, we can't solve your problem. She figured out a way to do it. This is the best Southwest Airlines story. There was an autistic guy, probably in his 30s, had severe mental challenges. And so he's being sent on this flight. He has the little lanyard around his neck that says the flight attendants are supposed to take care of him because he really can't take care of himself. So the flight attendants have seated him before everybody came on the airplane, and he's sitting in the front seat there. His name was Ralph. And so the flight attendant, this guy, he just starts his conversation with Ralph. Ralph has a little bit of a hard time carrying on a conversation, but he's enjoying the attention and the fact that this guy's really treating him like a regular human being. So he's just having this conversation as everybody's coming on the airplane. He's referring to, have y'all met Ralph? This is Ralph. He's with us today, and he's flying to Denver. And he just was bringing Ralph into every conversation. So then when he starts doing the FAA announcements, he says, I want to let you know that Ralph and I want you to do these things because Ralph and I think it's important for your safety. And he just brings Ralph into everything. And then he has Ralph stand up, and Ralph, don't you agree with this? And Ralph says, yeah. And everybody gives big applause for Ralph endorsing the FAA announcements. The flight attendant has Ralph distribute the pretzels. So he's doing the drink orders, and Ralph's distributing the pretzels. And then at the end of the flight, he says, I think we ought to all thank Ralph for all his help on this flight. Could everybody give him a big round of applause, just thunderous applause. And Ralph kind of blushes and stands up. And so, okay, this job, the job of this flight attendant is described. But can you do that more creatively? Can you make people's lives better on that flight? Can you make this disadvantaged person feel empowered and important? He took a creative approach to his job. Because Southwest Airlines said, let it all out, dude. Be just as creative as you possibly can as a flight attendant. That's what makes that airline the most profitable airline in the United States for the last two decades. Where airlines have faltered terribly, Southwest Airlines, profitable right straight through it. And even without Herb Kelleher, now there's the next generation of that same ethos of creativity. They screw up sometimes, let me tell you that. But generally, I think any job, any task, any business could benefit from releasing the creativity of all of the individuals within that. Okay, so we're going to talk about four topics as regards work and life. And this is this business of how do you have a lifestyle that helps you be more creative? The first topic is we are individually responsible for maintaining our own creativity. We have to continually have self-education. The idea that you're going to get a college degree and it's going to prepare you to do a career for the rest of your life, boy, that might have worked in the organizational age, but that ain't not going to cut it in the creative age. If you want to be a creative person, you've got to have constant self-education, and you're responsible for that. Responsible for self-stimulation, not boring yourself to death to the point that you can't think creatively anymore. And for lifelong learning, for being continuously growing and developing yourself further and further. So the first lesson of work and life is we're individually responsible for maintaining our own creativity. The second thing is we need to be defining our identity and our character. What is our occupation, not just our job? So that flight attendant that's helping that autistic guy, his job is to be a flight attendant. His occupation is to make everybody's life better on that plane, and especially maybe people who might have a disadvantage. So he has figured out, what do I believe in? What do I want to do? What is my intrinsic motivation? What am I trying to make my job so that it will give me that kind of satisfaction? We need to define and identify our character. The third thing is we need to figure out how to use time. Time and how we spend it is a crucial question for creative people. 40% of American population says that time is more important to them than money. The biggest issue in their life is time, not money, and having time to do what they want to do. So how we manage it is really important. And in order to be a creative person, you have to figure out, how am I orchestrating that? Because sometimes time can be your enemy in the creative process. So several things that are, we'll talk more about this maybe on Saturday, but the notion of interweaving. And this is how the workplace has changed so enormously just in the past 20 years. But it used to be, I described that, come in at 8 o'clock in the morning, this very structured day, leave at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, it is much more common in the workplace that you might get in at 6:30 if you're an early riser and you want to beat the traffic. And you might spend the first hour and a half of your day working very quietly before all the other people come in. And then when people come in, you start doing your more collaborative work. And then maybe you take off an hour or so in the middle of the morning and you do personal things. You do your emails with your friends. You check Facebook. You jack around on a video game and take a little break for an hour. And then go back to work and do a little collaborative work. And then maybe have a social lunch for 2 hours with a friend. And nobody's clocking you in and out. You can do that. And then come back and work until 4:30 and you leave and go home. Maybe somebody else is coming in at 10 o'clock and they're leaving at 8 o'clock and some people are working 12-hour days and some people are, that everybody's got a different kind of timing. And I think that's much more common in the workplace these days, this kind of interweaving of personal life and work life. And a lot of times that makes you more productive because when you're in a mindset to work, like getting in at 6:30 and doing that heads down hard work for an hour and a half, that's optimizing your productivity. So these irregular schedules sometimes make you way, way more productive. And your employer's like, cool, do that, dude, I'm all for it. When I was dean of the School of Architecture here, we initiated a 4-day work week. If you want to work 10 hours for 4 days, then you have an extra day off and you can make a 3-day weekend every weekend. I can't tell you how much the productivity went up when people just had the freedom to revise their schedule and work in a way that was made them happier and made them more fulfilled. And so how you manage your time, really crucial thing. The fourth thing is how you manage your cycle of life. How do you manage the length of your career? And, you know, some people have a front-end loaded career, and especially in some fields, like if you're a musician, damn, you better make it by the time you're 30 or it's going to be tough. So you better front-end load your career. Even if you're an academic, you know, you better get tenure. So you better front-end load your career, bust your ass those first 6-7 years of your career. Some careers need to be front-end loaded. Some careers are very steady state all the way through. If you're a nurse or you're a dentist, often what you do the first 5 years out of school and in your career is not that different than the kind of work you're going to be doing in the last 5 years of your career. It's steady state all the way through. Some people work their ass off until they're 55 years old and they retire, and then they spend 30, 35 years retired and traveling and doing things they want to do. These days we have choices about how we run the cycle of our career and of our life. These are decisions that sometimes that enhances your creativity to be able to have those different cycles. And these days, especially with work-life balance, trying to figure out, okay, how do I fit family into a cycle of my career, and how do I feel like I'm not, you know, running on a treadmill, but actually I'm able to manage my career and my family acceptably in each different stage of my life. So handling the cycle of life, how do you spend various eras? That's another very interesting work and life kind of decision. So those four things, we'll talk a little more about them on Saturday. And really, on Saturday, we're gonna talk a lot about how do you arrange for a work and life that would enhance your ability to have intrinsic motivation and to be a more creative person. Okay, Twitter card question for today. We've been talking a lot last time and this time about how things might be different over historical movement and how a creative age might be different than an organizational age or whatever. I want you to tell me, think of how you think your life and career might be different than your grandparents' life or career. How is the world of work and life different in your generation than it was in your grandparents' generation? And that could be how is it different economically? How is it different socially, culturally? How is it different in terms of lifestyle? How is it different in terms of work attitudes? What's different between your life and career and that of your grandparents?